This is part 5 of The Horse and the Rider. It's one story that begins at part 1, so if you haven't heard that, go back. And the Rider, Part 5, The Solution. Peter Quinnell Live exited Cynthia's house to the carport, where the smell of shit made him gag and pull his shirt over his nose. He also smelt terrible. His chest smelt of sweat and hair and skin oil. He tried not to breathe too deeply. He edged around the car to the back plate, squatted down, and resumed removing the number plate. His greasy hands kept losing their grasp on the screwdriver and he felt his anxiety rising, but after a short while the final screw fell into his hand and he tucked the second plate under his arm. "I'm ready," he hissed into the open house and realized he still didn't know the girl's name. "I'm Peter," he trailed off. She appeared in the doorway with a baseball bat, which she swung jauntily in one hand. "Jackie." He tried not to flinch. She set out towards the road. "Wait," he called out. Where are we going? Are you coming with me? I don't understand." "You're going," she said, "and I'm coming with you until you've gone far enough. Then I might come back." Peter nodded miserably and followed her back to his car, where she pointed the baseball bat at his custom plates. It was a nostalgic motion for Jackie, who had performed it every Saturday morning at softball games between the ages of 8 and 16. She had seen a documentary about Babe Ruth one Sunday afternoon and loved how he'd pointed his bat where he planned to hit the ball. It became her signature. Then, when she was 16, her feckless hippie parents walked out on a sandbar for yoga at low tide and meditated until the tide returned to wash them out to sea. After a 36-hour aerial search, they were declared presumed dead, and Jackie moved in with her cantankerous grandmother, who cancelled softball. "Here?" Peter asked, staring aghast in the direction Jackie was pointing the bat. "The number plates? What if someone sees us?" "Where else are you going to do it?" she asked scornfully. "If they see you, I'll tell them you killed my nan." Jackie clashed with her nan for several ideological reasons, including Cynthia's firm belief in what she described as traditional Aussie values, which included mateship, working hard, not taking yourself too seriously, whites only, a fair crack for everyone, and no queers and no communists. The two sparred infrequently and half-heartedly. Cynthia, because she despised her granddaughter's politics but couldn't bring herself to overly invest in the life of the teen-shaped burden she'd had no choice in raising, and Jackie, because talking to her nan was at best a chore. She was uninterested in converting her grandmother to a gentler way of thinking. It was easier to simply not talk, since talking led to arguing. They were all the family each other had in their lives, and virtually all they had at all. When Jackie finished school, she said goodbye to all her friends who moved to the city to go to uni and get good jobs at real estate agencies and event planning companies. She got a job as a labourer and kept it for a few months before quitting in disgust at the lousy pay and boring work. "You'll find something that suits you a bit more," her boss, Ricky, a solid man in his 40s who most people would assume had his heart in the right place, told her. She knew what he meant. He meant a girl job. She started to think he was right. Ricky did have his heart in the right place, but the fact that everyone assumed that and were correct was a lucky fluke. Ricky's motivations were almost entirely unexamined by him or anyone else, with the exception of an ex-girlfriend who told him as she was moving out that his heart was in the right place, but it didn't matter if he was such a fucking idiot. Ricky accepted her verdict, but found no actionable directives in it, so changed nothing. Ricky's father, a cantankerous old Italian man, was the only other who provided Ricky with any amount of analysis. His father often told him he didn't use his head. Ricky didn't really know where to start. After Ricky's gentle parting gift, Jackie collected the doll for a while and settled into a comfortable bog of depression. She played video games, smoked weed, and posted mopey cries for help on Facebook for 6 months, until one night at Shell Harbour League's club she met a moderately attractive and almost well-dressed truckie named Jeanette, who bought her 3 tequila sunrises and took Jackie back to her house. The next morning, Jackie peered through Jeanette's dingy lace curtains and realised she was only 2 streets away from her nan's house, and promptly spent the next 6 months stumbling back and forth between the two properties until Jeanette took a knee and asked her to move in. She did. It was fine. She got a job as a cook at the local fish and chip shop. She saw Jeannie when Jeannie wasn't driving her truck to Queensland or Victoria or South Australia. She assumed the sense of calm she was feeling was happiness, until one bright, cold morning, Jeanette pulled her semi-trailer up out the front of their depressing 2-bedroom brick house, slowly walked into the bedroom, and told Jackie she had to move out. After Jeanette left her, Jackie quit her job at the chippy and welcomed the oncoming depression. She bought a carton of cigarettes and lay on her grandmother's couch for a couple of weeks, waiting for the black dog to return. But fueled by anger, it abandoned her too. It stumped her. She felt strangely directionless without the nagging presence that had shadowed her on and off since she was a teenager. But after a short contemplation of the subject, she realised she had no choice but to get on with it. She got off the couch and got a new job at a news agency and read the magazines. She moved back into her grandmother's old caravan. She worked and smiled at customers and impressed Margret, the old Austrian friend of her grandmother's who owned the news agency, so much that she promoted Jackie to chief stockist. She was the only stockist, but she revelled in her new responsibility. She began a comprehensive audit of the magazines the shop carried and unearthed several troubling trends. The most urgent of these was that the news agency had returned 100% of their stock of dirt biking magazines for the previous 16 months consecutively, meaning valuable shelf real estate was being taken up by titles no one was interested in. At the same time, they were stocking only one sailing title, despite the news agency's proximity to Lake Illawarra, and selling out of it every month. Jackie took drastic action. She cancelled their order with the dirt biking title, increased the sailing magazine order, and ordered a few copies of a popular kayaking magazine as an experiment. It was a phenomenal success. The dirt biking magazine went unmourned while the sailing and kayaking magazines sold out quickly. Jackie got back on the phone to the sailing title about increasing their order for the next month.
"Oh, selling like hotcakes,"
said Leanne, who was the editor, reporter, head of advertising and sales rep, and Jackie agreed. Leanne offered to send out a high-gloss cardboard cutout of celebrity sailor Mark Richards standing in front of popular superyacht Wild Oats 11.
"Oh, please," Jackie gushed, and that was it.
Leanne called the newsagent back the next day to ask if they wanted to increase the order again, and Jackie giggled nervously and reminded her that they'd only increased it the day before. And Leanne apologised and said she was completely run off her feet, but she'd really enjoyed their conversation the day before and had forgotten they'd talked business.
"You sound like you could do with a cup of coffee," Jackie told her,
and followed through with, "Wish I could buy you one." She couldn't quite believe the words she'd said, and her hand spasmed back towards the phone's cradle. But before she could hang up, Leanne let loose a deep, confident chuckle and said,
"Oh, I'd love that. Come on down the road,"
she told Jackie.
"To Albury. That's where our offices are, and I might just let you."
The next day, Leanne called the news agency and told Jackie she'd told the warehouse to express post the Mark Richards cutout to her as a priority. And the day after that, Jackie called Leanne personally to tell her they'd received it and texted her a photo of the cutout as the centerpiece of a huge and intricate visual marketing display she'd set up in the front window of the newsagent. Around the sides and on the floor was white netting she'd bought from Spotlight at Warrawong. Hanging from the ceiling were some balsa wood birds Jackie had found at the Salvos and painted white, grey and red like seagulls. And leaning against one corner was an old-fashioned rubber life buoy she'd bought from an elderly sailor at the yacht club. Across the top was a hand-drawn banner reading, "Recreational Sailor, on sale now." And in pride of place was the cutout of Mark Richards. Leanne texted back the emoji with hearts for eyes, and it was the first text she sent her. One evening, Jackie left her phone unlocked on Cynthia's kitchen counter, and the angry old woman snooped her way into some explicit messages. She'd had her suspicions about Jeanette, the truck-driving housemate with whom Jackie had seemed unusually close, but here was the whole truth. She shook with anger as she ordered Jackie out. Jackie took a sleeping bag down to the big storm water pipe.
"Come down and visit,"
Leanne told her as Jackie sobbed into the phone. The next day, Margret told her she was fired.
"Your grandmother says you have extra spending money,"
she barked angrily. Why is there money missing from my accounts, but you have extra spending money? Get out before I call the police. She stood seething on the footpath as it began to rain. Her sleeping bag in the storm water pipe washed away. Her grandmother put her things out on the lawn. The water got in. She slept on a bench under the train station awning. In the middle of the night, she awoke to a new quiet. The rain had stopped. She sat up and looked out at the stars shining overhead and the orange glow of the far-off city lights. She'd spent her whole life shuffling between shitty little suburbs, low houses and strip malls, poverty and boredom. Maybe it was time to throw a log on the fire. The next morning, Jackie waited until Cynthia took her creaking, ancient Mitsubishi up the road to go to the tab and buy a tea cake and slipped in the back door. She began picking through the old house's dark corners, looking for the nest egg she knew was stashed away from the race in 2002 that Cynthia had chucked $200 on the trifecta and come away with 20 grand. The night before, for the first time, Leanne had confided in her that the magazine was in trouble.
"I hate to talk about money," she'd said awkwardly. "Still, it'll be nice to just have your company."
It was an irresistible call to action. That was when Peter Quinnell Live had showed up. Peter undid the screws on the front and back plates and replaced them with Cynthia's plates without a hitch. Perfect. He got a plastic bag from the boot of the car and wrapped his old custom plates in the bag and pushed them down a storm water drain to avoid suspicion if he was pulled over by police and the car searched. "Are you ready?" he asked. And she was. As soon as he lowered himself into the driver's seat, Peter began to relax. Had everything gone according to plan? He had to concede it had not, between the death of the old woman and her chaotic granddaughter hitching a ride. But despite it all, he felt the glow of optimism beginning to blossom in his stomach. The open road was his again. He had a 2/3 full tank of petrol, a selection of classic albums in the glove box, and a companion who, if mildly terrifying, seemed committed to escaping from someone or something. That was comforting. He eased out of Cynthia's street, around the corner and onto the highway. She directed him. The car wound its way through a couple of roundabouts until it found a straight, and, at long last, hit speed. The open road cleared space in his mind for other things to tumble in again. The sudden, disgusting death of the Greek. The old woman's round, O-mouth surprise as she leaned out of the door and abruptly fell to her death. Peter felt for them. His heart swelled for them and for their families, who were probably currently in enormous amounts of pain as they struggled to come to terms with the death of their loved ones. Except for the old woman, Peter remembered. He looked sidelong at Jackie. She was the old woman's family, and she didn't seem too upset. Not upset at all, he noted, and he wondered why. Shock could be a factor. He knew it was normal for those who had been affected by a sudden and traumatic stroke of fate to deny reality or to have a blunted emotional response. But the girl's reaction would also be normal, Peter thought, if she simply didn't like her grandmother and felt unaffected by her death. It rang true. Of the two explanations, both of which were entirely normal, Peter recognized, the second felt more accurate. He remembered his childhood dog, Patty, an adorable wire-haired terrier cross who'd commanded the Quinnell Live family's attention instantly with a charismatic prancing display the day they'd visited the animal shelter to find a pet. They'd brought Patty home, where he'd gradually revealed his true colors as an ungrateful and disobedient beast with a significant rebellious streak.
"The dog's buried the leash again," Peter remembered his father growling one winter evening.
It was the culmination of a long, fraught standoff between the Quinnell Live humans and Patty, who understood all too well the symbolism of the leash and had attempted to shrug off the yoke of human control by burying it. The next day, Patty was returned to the dog shelter, and the family did without a dog from then on. The memory seemed analogous, Peter thought, with what he perceived Jackie to be dealing with now. While Patty had been a cute puppy, even as a child, Peter could see why it was best he be returned, and he'd resolved not to perform grief just to placate those who expected it of him. Similarly, the girl's relationship with her grandmother was probably very complicated. He had no right to expect her to be sad about the death of her grandmother. As the car carrying Peter Quinnell Live and Jackie drove south and west, Judith Senyol summoned Perry Algiers into her office. Perry was afraid. He was a middle-aged man with a shiny bald dome and a dense, even horseshoe of hair around the back and sides of his skull. His head looked like someone was trying to pick up a very hot volleyball with an oven mitt. It looked like a white pool cue ball which had half of a tennis ball wrapped around the back, or a delicate pale green honeydew melon on which someone had draped a hand towel. Perry was nervous around his superiors, and nervous around his subordinates, and his nervousness took form in crawling acquiescence to the former and venomous anger with the latter. He was a sub-editor, a dying breed, and he knew it. He loudly told everyone about the importance of quality control mechanisms such as himself, and he was perpetually terrified that they didn't value him and resentful that they valued him too much. He equally loudly told the same people that his workload was too heavy and that the idiots underneath him needed to do a better job of sub-editing themselves instead of wasting his time with their wet, turgid copy. He had never had a meeting that had gone well, and as a result, he flinched constantly whenever he was called to one. Judith picked up the small laser printer that sat on her desk and turned it around so it faced the single, stylish, Danish-designed wooden chair in front of her desk. Into her word processor, she typed, "Close the door," then printed it and pointed furiously at the printer. Perry picked up the paper. "You want me to close the door?" he asked. Judith mimed shooting herself in the head, slitting her own throat and hanging herself, then rolled her eyes and mouthed, "Yes." Perry closed the door. She typed, "Need to talk about PQL," then hit print and pointed at the printer again. "Why can't you talk?" he ventured timidly. Her keyboard clacked for a long time, until at last, with a whine, another sheet of A4 paper fed from the printer. 8 ice pack filler some moron threw out of window, landed in gutter, found myself in feedback loop, research for understanding / commitment with tour group and had to eat filling, not discussing it. Doctor told me not to talk or breathe heavily for minimum 14 days or risk thick layer of scar tissue covering my entire tongue and palate. Very painful. Doc said I might never talk again if I fuck this up. If I ever catch the fucker that did this to me, I'll murder him. Perry promised himself that he would never, ever admit the truth to Judith and made a mental note to threaten and coerce anyone who may have seen him toss the pack. He cleared his throat and said, "Sorry to hear it, Judith." Another sheet emerged from the printer. "Peter? Seems he's a person of interest in the investigation. Nothing yet about charges or an arrest. We should probably still take him off air for a few months until all the fuss dies down. Delay the rollout of his public screens." "Furious. Bastard forced me into a corner. Re-throat," she printed. Perry nodded even though he didn't understand. It wasn't worth asking, but what she meant was that she felt that Peter's circumstances had initiated the snowball that ended in her scarred throat tissue, and that if it weren't for him, she wouldn't have been backed into the corner of eating ice pack filler to impress the chairman and his daughter. Judith rose to her feet and moved for the door so quickly Perry gripped the sides of his chair in apprehension.
What's the matter?" he stammered.
Judith gave him a horrible smile.
"I'm taking care of it," she rasped.
Blood splashed violently on the carpet. Perry gagged, which would have satisfied Judith hugely if she wasn't already halfway across the office, loping in huge exuberant strides towards the fire stairs and the car park, where she gunned her matte black Mazda convertible out of the Five News garage and sped all the way to the unremarkable rowing club on the banks of the Parramatta River, where Sydney's wealthy met with the underworld when dirty jobs needed doing. The rowing club was a boxy two-story building with parking underneath. Judith skidded her car across two spaces and stomped 3 at a time up the stairs that wrapped around 2 aspects of the building. Inside, a hard-to-place clientele mix of post-work business people and pot-bellied former rowers hunched over wooden tables with beers and baskets of fish and chips. Judith took a seat at the bar and ordered the signal drink of a caipirinha with mint and 2 straws. A pale man in all black slid onto the stool next to her. His hair was thick and bristly, cut to a uniform 1 centimetre on all sides and creeping onto his forehead in a severe widow's peak. It gave his head the look of a hedgehog. He had large, strong teeth and eyes that were enormous and close together and glittered as he looked at her in a strange, unfocused stare. He seemed to be looking past her. "Yes?" he inquired in an elegant transatlantic accent. Judith took a sip of the drink. Blood mingled with the mint leaves.
"It's an employee of mine," she rasped. "He's causing trouble. I want him gone for good. I don't care how, just out of the picture."
She sipped again and slid a photo of Peter across the bar. The drink was brown now.
"I know this man," the hitman said. "This is a man from the television. Very visible, very expensive."
"Yes, yes,"
Judith snapped impatiently.
"Give me a number."
The hitman smiled.
"No numbers,"
he said.
"I am interested in relics of antiquity. Busts, bas reliefs, carvings, petrified items, things of this nature. Bric-a-brac of the ancient world. I will provide a list of items I am interested in acquiring, and you will procure one." this is my price. Judith slammed her reddened glass down on the counter and roared with laughter.
Funny,
she wheezed. The hitman smiled past her again. There is nothing funny about my price, he said. I will help you to understand. The ancient world was small and personal. They lived their lives by rules dictated by what could be seen and heard and felt. The horizon was too large a mystery for them to contemplate. They prayed each night when the sun went down for its restoration in the morning. They used crude tools to craft crude reproductions of their existence. You may not wish, the hitman muttered softly, leaning in close to Judith, to be reminded of how soft your hands are, how weak and unskilled, how used to simply invoking the labor of machines, how accustomed to being the waypoint through which the creation of something real must pass. But I crave that reminder. I wish to see and to touch something created by one man with one tool. To me, this is the only thing worth working for. The hitman slid a small scroll of paper along the bar to Judith. It was styled in such a way that the outside looked like a cigarette. Judith placed it in her purse. I require payment in full, the hitman told Judith. I will meet you here at this time in 3 nights. You will pay me, and I will make your problem go away. Thanks for listening to The Horse and the Rider. It's written, read, and produced by me, Max Laverne. I'd love to hear from you if you've been enjoying it. You can tweet at me, prawn_meat, or send me an email, maxlaverne@gmail.com. If you'd like to support the podcast, you can make a donation at ko-fi.com/maxlaverne. If you know anyone who's into games that don't exist, make sure you tell them about this podcast, because next week in episode 6, there's the first of 2 fictional games that will appear in this story, so it's a great time to roll the dice, as they probably say.